Hello, cyclocross friends. That was a pretty good one, wasn't it? I had a little hello cyclocross friends therapy session while we were out at cyclocross nationals, and I think I'm back in being able to distinguish between the podcast hello cyclocross friends and the heat check cyclocross friends. I know I've talked about this before. Honestly, I really don't think about it until I hit record for these intros. It's not like I'm just at home obsessing about how I say the word hello, but I like to share that with you all. And the other thing I'm going to share is episode 170 of Cyclocross Radio. That's what we're about to listen to. It's another episode of the Media Pit with Zach and Michael, and we're talking about Cyclocross Nationals, of course. What else would we be talking about? Leave all that European stuff for down the road. We'll leave Matthew Vanderpoel and the streak being over for down the road. We have other ending streaks to talk about, more important ones, and those happened right here in the United States. So we're going to get to all that, follow up on all the storylines that we thought were interesting throughout the week. I'm sure a lot of them you already know about, but you get to hear our take on it. So we're going to do that in a minute. But first off, I want to tell you about Works, our favorite sponsor. The Hydra Shot is an amazing product. I saw so many Hydra Shots out in Tacoma. It warmed my cold cyclocross heart to see all of you figuring out what we already knew at the Wide Angle Podium Network. And the cool thing is that we have new code. So you can go to yourcleanbike.com, and put in the code GEARUP, all one word, GEARUP, GEARUP. And that'll give you 15% off of everything at yourcleanbike.com. And the things that I look at, I mean, I love all of the Hydro Shot accessories and the Hydro Shot itself, so many different brushes and window squeegees and everything else that you need. But what I like too is, you know, just looking at it from especially a video, for me, shooting a lot of video, and it becomes like 5 o'clock in the evening and there's no sun left and you still got to do like interviews with people, I'm getting myself a couple of these 20 volt PowerShare LED work lights, using my battery from the Hydra Shot, plugging it in there because it's the same battery for everything that they sell, and I'm set. I got myself a little nighttime studio that I can just carry around. That's one of the cool extra items on here that I'm picking up. And let me know what you're picking up by going to yourcleanbike.com and using the code GEARUP. Holiday season is here, which means you're going to be at home with the family and the friends. And after a while, you're going to be like, ooh, I need to check out. And that's when you check in the wideanglepodium.com. Download the latest from all of your favorite podcasts, including the Slow Ride, Bike Shop CX, Gravel Lot. They just started season 3, Consummate Athlete, USA Communique. We're about to record the third one of that show. On the video side, we got the CX Heat Check. One more episode to go. You can find that at CX Hairs YouTube channel, youtube.com/CX Hairs. One more CX Heat Check left in the season. But there's also, we got a lot of Nationals videos going up there too. So enough to keep you busy during this holiday time. What else is going to keep you busy is episode 170 of Cyclocross Radio. And we're going to do that right now. All right, we are back in the Media Pit with Michael, who was our remote Nationals correspondent, and then also Zach, who, like myself, was on the grounds in let's see if I can say this right, Stellicom Park. It was supposed to be, it's like Silicon. Oh, Stellicom.
It's not Coom, it's Stellicom.
I heard it was like Silicon.
Okay.
And then just say that like Stellicom.
All right. Did you get that from Scott Herman? I mean, Scott Herman,
yes,
is usually pretty.
I did
pretty
get that from,
okay,
Scott,
all right,
Herman.
Okay. Yeah. 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 He always.
And
yeah,
he was doing it, and then they had a local announcer out there, Alex, and he still was like correcting him every time he said it. So there's something. There's something I know I'm not getting right. That it's just, you have to live there to be able to deliver that. But I'm getting ahead of myself, because before we go any farther, Michael, how's it going?
What, do I have like a bit I'm supposed to do here? Is that...
That seems to be what we've established.
Well,
yes.
Okay, well, maybe. I don't know. So anyway, I told you guys this in the green room that I was watching the single speed race while I was lifting, getting a little exercise in, trying to research that race. It seemed like it had a lot of good storylines there. And, you know, I'm also trying to figure out, like, what is the deal with single speed and, like... Trying to get a gauge on what people love about that race, you know. And at the end, you know, you've got like Ben who like lost his shoe and he sprints past DeVoust who's like in a t-shirt, but like, so like Ben's trying to get on the podium, and then like I see Bill, you give Ben a hug, and then Zach, you're out there with your Blues Clues like taking notes, and then like DeHaan's taking a photo, and I'm like, man, that looks like a heckin' good time. And then I just had this moment of clarity. Single speed is the gravel of cyclocross.
I'll accept
well
it.
Done.
I'll accept
well
it. Well done.
I never would have guessed like how deep that one was gonna go. Like that was a deep cut.
I was expecting
to say that, you know, you found nationals very engaging, like to watch.
No,
oh,
I like
wow.
I like I am all for long walks. All the time.
No. Michael was so good. I never would have guessed. Like, that was just, like, that was perfect.
But you guys probably wrote down gauge, right? I mean, I'm sure you wrote down gauge.
The Clara part was good. That was well done.
Look, Clara is hard to work with. I didn't really know what to do. And also, I like this because I think it does kind of bring in, like, something I hope we talk about later, the single speed race and, like, the amount of storylines in that race. And, like, that was one race... I promoted a race this weekend in New Orleans, our regional championship. So I had no idea. I didn't watch anything live. I had nothing, no idea what was going on. But I did catch some of that single speed action on Instagram. I think Squid was posting their stories. And, like, to see Anthony, like, come from back row to, you know, and making that charge. And the Instagram coverage that I saw was way better than the live coverage, but because they must have been in the right spot, and they were catching people just like cheering on Anthony, and just like the background to that, his whole story, like not racing this year but going to single speed worlds, and I don't know. So anyway, a lot of cool stuff going on in that single speed race. I hope we'll get to it maybe later, but I thought that was a good intro. Like, you guys are on the ground, I had to watch from the computer, so.
Well, should we just start with the single speed race? I mean, we have
it's
on the agenda. Let's do it. Let's talk single speed.
All right.
Yeah, I guess that comes in sequence, right? Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there was a lot going on. Like that race had storylines. It had people that we know, people we love, and crazy stuff happening.
Well, and we also know that, you know, just starting. From I'd say starting from Austin on, the single speed has kind of become the marquee event. Like that, people show up on Saturday specifically for the single speed race. And I'd say maybe not this year, but maybe last year, like we had crowds that rivaled the elite races for the single speed race. So it's definitely a draw.
Yeah, that's one thing that was last year. There was that descent, the first descent into the bowl where everyone was eating it. And Billy, you had like just the ultimate supercut of crashes on there. So it wasn't quite as exciting this year. I mean, the descents were nothing could rival how gnarly and hard to ride that descent was, and having 154, I think it was 154 people this year.
This year, yeah, they cut it off at 150, and then somehow two more just snuck in there, or four more.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so, like, the story was, I mean, like, right, was Jake Wells was defending his title. He was perfect. He was a perfect 5-for-5 between Masters and single speed during his Masters career coming in. But, you know, so, like, it was kind of interesting, right? Ben Frederick has finished, you know, he's done well at some UCI points or at some UCI races. You know, he jumped in there. What are you guys' thoughts about, you know, this, I guess this started in Austin, but, you know, a UCI racer like Ben Frederick jumping in, is that cool? Is that a cross move? Is that a weak move? What are your thoughts on...
I think for Ben specifically, it is cool because if you talk to Ben, yes, he signed up for the elite race, but that was not his A race. Like the single, he came in with the single speed as the A race, and the sort of criticism or whatever, the little controversy that started around Austin was that it was more the elite racers. It was the year that they did not allow elite racers to race masters as well. That was like the first year. So if you were, you know, a baby master, you couldn't race that sort of as a paid up session, the course, which is what a lot of them used to do, and then race the elite race. So that option was taken away, yet the loophole was you could still race the single speed. So you could get laps in, you could get, you know, 45 minutes of laps in the single speed. And the problem that the pure single speeders saw was the elite racers coming in there just to recon the course, yet they still have elite power and they're ending up, you know, winning and taking away the podium from the people that are true single speeders.
Bill, would you say that the laps that they were doing during those races, would you say those were hot laps?
I would say there were hot laps, and that's a great segue, because the person who in the pages of Cyclocross magazine, and I believe at that time it may have even been in the pages, wrote an article who said, hey, this is our community, this is kind of our culture around single speed, and it's not cool for these other people to race it.
To appropriate it.
Yeah. Was Hot Laps Craig, who at the time was a Seattle guy. And was in the whole Hodala scene since that time. He's moved out and hung out with us over in the Mid-Atlantic and especially the D.C. and Baltimore area. Craig went back. He was there. He wasn't racing. He was like, I'm done with racing nationals. But he was hanging out with all of his old buds. So it was good to see Hot Laps Craig on site cheering on all the single speeders. His first time back at nationals since the dust up.
So Zach, to go to your point though with Ben and I'll kind of,
I mean, I didn't mean to say, I don't want to single him out, but like, I mean, I think there were a few riders in that race who are also doing the elite race who have,
well,
like,
I mean, Jake
raced
Wells,
UCI this year.
Jake Wells himself, former pro level rider, who is, you know, just crushing. So, you know, we could kind of throw him in there too, but this is kind of his thing now as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess with Ben, it's like he's raced a single speed in the elite races all year. And, you know, you see the interviews on Dirtwire. He's so stoked when he rips it on the single speed. So, and just his personality and the way he's sort of taken a different view after his TBI of like the sport. Like, I don't quite understand the spirit, like purity of a single speed, but like I get it with Ben. And so, like, I mean, him and Jake, they were racing. This was not like, they were not wearing costumes. They were not, you know, taking hand-ups. Like, they were legit racing. And I mean, it was a really good race that came down to like a bizarro mechanical.
Yeah. And just to put a pin on that point, Jake is somebody as well who will be in super competitive, you know, in there with like, Chris Drummond and other guys who are like could compete at the elite level, UCI level, as Jay could as well. And in those races, he also will swap out and do laps on his single speed. So it's kind of interesting that both of these racers will take their geared bike races at the highest level and be more than happy to turn a couple laps on the single speed and not lose any space or time, which is just amazing.
Yeah, so then I guess like the other player that was involved in our storyline was Sikwutz.
Yeah.
Our man, Anthony Clark. He was back. Anthony, I know he's been busy with he's working on his family business. And I know it's been a really busy year for him. And so he kind of had to put the kibosh on racing. He showed up at the Single Speed World Championships. And I think he finished second. Yeah, I think he finished second there behind Max Chance.
I looked for results. I can't find them.
They're not on Cyclocross 24.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And they're not even on CX Magazine. Come on,
yeah,
Zach.
They are. We had the top three. Yeah. I asked for results for Single Speed Worlds, and the promoter said there was so much cheating going on that we can't really do results.
The promoter said, go fuck yourself.
Yes.
It's not pure. Yeah.
So Anthony Clark. So, you know, I guess I knew this because coming back and racing my first year, I know everything about how the USAC and cross results ranking systems work. But, you know, Anthony went to Worlds. He went to Europe last year, but it only takes your races from the last 12 months. So probably the only race that was eligible for him for his call up was Nats last year, since he hasn't raced. And so he started on the 13th row way back. I think he was the 102nd call up.
Man, is there, yeah,
it's really interesting that they did call ups per UCI. So like Carla Williams in the women's race was like, I think on the front row, it might've been like the first single speed race she had done.
I think it's by USAC points.
Oh, it's USAC points?
USAC points. Yeah. But like, so Anthony didn't have any USAC points. Oh, like he had all those 600s those races. So, terrible call up position, probably only in front of all the Hodala guys who, you know, don't race USAC sanctioned races. And he was like in third place, but like by the end of the first lap, pretty
much. Which is amazing because I have footage. I still have to go through my single speed footage, but I got some pretty good shots. But one of the things I wanted to do just with that field size was go to the first run up, and it didn't end. I mean, the video isn't great because the riders start blocking my camera, and I like tried to put it like over my head and sort of pan down to get the tail, and it just was like on and on and on, and Michael, you'll appreciate that. So the angle was on the outside of the course, but the problem was that if you wanted to catch them again, you had to be on the inside to sort of sprint to the next spot.
Yeah,
but being on the outside, you were kind of stuck there, and I was there for like 5 minutes. until I can move to like the next spot, because it just kept going.
I mean, this is what I'm saying. Like, I'm kind of joking, but like, really, single speed is the gravel. You have like the party. I mean, you have the business in the front with Ben and Anthony and Jake, and then you got the party in the back with the guys, you know, wearing glitter pants and literally people just walking up and like, you know, in the live stream, they're just like showing footage of like people in 97th place plotting up the hill, and you're just like, okay, yeah, I guess not, this is not, you just like throwing the bone hard to all the amateurs who like give money to the race. But
yeah, let's not be too hard on glitter pants, because I believe in the women's race that was second place.
Okay, I guess I was trying to like, so the costumes, but yeah, like I said, Stephen DeBoss, he had a costume where he was like top five or something, so.
Well, the women are certainly more fun. Like, yes. Without a doubt, Sarah Sturm has been, you know, a great leader. Her and Emily Schladuck, her friend, it was kind of cool that, you know, they're like besties, and they're pretty good friends from Durango, and they were both costumed up, and just a number of women. Meredith Miller was wearing like flannel or something, and she was just out there having a blast, like shit-eating grin on her face the whole time. So, I mean, if there is a challenge out there, it's for dudes to, you know, Stefan DeVoust, follow the leadership of Stefan, and, you know, do some more costumes.
What was he doing?
Didn't he wear like a button down that he full schlecked or something? Michael?
Yeah,
that makes
it,
sense.
Like, had a white collar, so I don't know if he was trying to be a priest or what was going on there.
I think he like full schlecked by the end of the race, though. Like,
oh yeah, he was flapping everywhere.
Well, I know that like at Epic Rides, some of those guys, I'm not sure if he is one of them, will do just kind of the like bibs only for the fat tire crits, and then just sort of Sharpie their team name onto their chest.
Nice.
Oh, if only
I like
could
that,
do
though.
That.
I mean, it's like, that's fun, and you can still race at a top level while having fun. I think it just sets the vibe, especially. I think the women, so much kudos to them for just setting that precedent.
I think the only downfall for Sarah Sturm in her race is that, because of her, what she was wearing when she was sticking all of the dollar bills down her shirt, it wasn't tight enough, so she was losing a lot of money on the course.
Yeah, she should have worn the single speed corset like she did last year. She went back to the jorts.
Yeah,
she threw it back to Reno and went with the jorts. So, you know,
so single speed race is also a good opportunity for those elite racers to make a few bucks.
So
Michael, what was your thought? Like, you know, you were watching the single speed race. We didn't necessarily know what was going on. I mean, Ben Frederick was in the lead what happened and what was kind of the, what were you seeing when things were going down?
You know, so I luckily watched it just now, but I saw online earlier, you know, Ben had a lead. He actually gapped Jake pretty well. And then all of a sudden he's like not pedaling very well. And apparently he like busted a cleat in his shoe, his lace-up shoe, I think. And you see in the live stream, and I heard this online, is that he yelled to his teammate Leslie Etheridge. It was like, I need a shoe. And she sprinted like a mile or something, like broke some like marathon record, and like brought him a shoe to the pit that I think he had to tie back on and finish the race. So
yeah, because he was definitely on a lap with the broken cleat, which how he kept, what did he end up, third?
Third.
He finished third, yeah.
Yeah, how he kept that lead, I'm not sure. I want to take a little bit of blame for Frederick's downfall.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I don't know if I should admit this, but I was walking.
Breaking.
I was walking by the announcers, and I yelled up to Herman. I was like, "Frederick's beating Wells. You can, you know."
I remember that.
You can put and then Scott was like, Scott, "Well, Bill Shiken just said that Ben Frederick's winning this race. It's over." And then, like, not 3 minutes later, the cleat explodes.
That legit happened. I remember that. Yeah, Scott exactly. was making a big deal out of it. He's like, we have official word.
Well, can we talk about some... there were some rumblings, and I don't think it was very serious, but that Jake Wells was pitting like every lap trying to get, I assume, for a different gear ratio for a different part of the course. I didn't quite grasp the course, so I can't tell you, you know...
Interesting.
And then,
I had not heard this. This is very interesting. Is this in the spirit of the single speed?
But wait, so did the announcers, because this, like, I'm assuming this came from the live stream. Did the announcers know that he was on different gear ratios? Like, what was
the, so how did I heard I didn't the, know. The, I didn't the know. Dust up on Twitter before.
But how
and
did
then
people
I just,
know?
Huh?
How did people know? Like, was like, did Tim Johnson have like some inside info? Like Meredith Miller? Like,
well, I mean, you know, they're seeing him pit every lap, and they're racers, and they race single speed, so they kind of were like, don't think he has a mechanical. Is he just trying to get a clean bike? Could be wanting a different ratio.
I don't understand. Just walk me through this, Zach. I'm just going through the course in my head. Where would you, I mean, I guess up top you would want a harder?
You would want a spinnier gear for the up top after the second run-up, because there's that long climb.
Because there's the false flat all the way up.
Yeah. I mean, so like in theory, but like what was really interesting to me about this course is that I asked Jake, because everyone was making a big deal of Jake Wells in his Masters race going to his single speed as his pit bike. And I appreciate it because he was kind of like, hey, I only could bring three bikes. And so, you know, I only have one geared bike. It's like, you know, it's like he's a Masters. He's getting, you know, he's living the Masters life, albeit with three bikes at Nats, whatever. but the course was such that, like, it was either flat or you were off the bike running. And so there wasn't really a disadvantage for running a single speed. So that was kind of interesting in that regard. Although there was that long false climb, the orchard section up top. It was kind of false flatty, climby a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
So that might have been what he was doing.
But that's like a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because it was false flat, but what happened after you got past the false flat and all the way up to the pointy end of the orchard was this huge descent all the way back down to the drop.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but like, so, I mean, are you not allowed to pit? Was the argument that you're not allowed to just pit in single speed one bike? Like, what was the scuttlebutt?
The detractors, you know, like, run what you brung, sort of the single speed, you know, as Slow Ride Podcast says, rock the one cog. You just like whatever gear ratio you happen to put on your bike when you were a messenger, you know, 10 years ago, like that's what you have to ride at Cross Nats. And if you're switching for like a different advantage, then
the suicide setup.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it was sort of in light fun. I saw a few people say like we have no, like I heard saw Ben's teammate say like, we don't care that Jake's a great guy. We don't care that like he was switching like bikes. I think people were just kind of chatting about it. And I don't know, guys. I mean, I'm a newbie to single speed, and I'm probably gonna get a lot of shit for this. Like, I do the zip tie. Like, I'll just zip tie my gears on my bike. And like, and I'll tell you why I do, is because oftentimes a single speed race is earlier in the day or it's a shorter amount of time. So like, if I have other obligations at the race, I can get in a quick race and then I can go do other things. And so like, I've kind of gravitated towards single speed because of that reason. And like, so I'm on the complete opposite of those people who are like always riding single speed. But so I don't think it's a big issue. I think it's,
have you with your zip tie ever, finger quote, accidentally shifted down during a race?
No,
because that's always this thing. It's like, it's even, they'll just like slip.
I think that's Shimano though. So,
well, you can't zip tie Shimano's.
Okay,
you can only zip tie.
No, SRAM. I haven't ever accidentally.
Well, like, so here's a question. Like, I mean, I guess the criticism was like, oh, he was running different gears, but like in cyclocross, like, we, like, that's part of the sport. We were talking about it during the pit discussion, right? Part of the sport is what tire treads are you running? What gears are you running? What cassette are you running? I mean, to me, it almost seems like an interesting, like, if you have two bikes, an interesting strategy thing. Like, hey, would I benefit from being on a different gear ratio for this part of the course? And to me, it just seems like that's part of, it's interesting, like, that we celebrate it in every other aspect. If, you know, someone's like, oh, I pitted and went to my super mega no brakes carbon bike for the climb at the last lap. Like,
yeah, I would say that this community is fighting against that.
Okay. All right.
That would be the thing. Sure. Like I would even say that, not to get back into last week's discussion, but if you were to say no pits for single speed races, I think that that would go over well.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was thinking the same. I actually wrote down that note while watching that race, that this is where you test Bill's hypothesis in single speed.
One bike,
no pits,
and that's it. Maybe neutral wheels. But then the thing about neutral wheels would then you would have to have like a whole set of wheels with different cogs on them.
Oh, you'd also need neutral shoes for Ben.
Oh man, too soon on the neutral shoes.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, if Ben Frederick were a mountain biker, he would have never shown up to the pits without a spare set of shoes. I think most cyclocross racers do, right? I mean, at this point, isn't that part of the
well, pit, yes, pit package? Lawrence Sweeks, like, always busting his shoes at cross races, so you know he's got extra shoes in the pit.
Was it Wout or Vanderpoel that used to have, like, the shoe problems?
Oh, man.
Right? Did one of them, like, switch shoes a lot?
Yeah,
like,
I know.
There were a couple races?
I think there was a race where Vanderpoel had to switch shoes. I think it might have been him, where he had to like pit and switch shoes, and he probably still won the race, even though he had to swap shoes.
Yeah.
So,
are we going to make it? I like that we may make it through this whole thing without talking about the end of the streak.
Well, I have that in my notes.
Okay.
Well, speaking of streak, I think we should move on.
Of course, I was talking about Katie Compton, not Matthew Vanderpoel.
Right. I'm talking about both. But I think in my mind, the biggest story of the weekend was in the women's elite race, and was Clara Hunziker winning the elite title over Katie Compton. And I think that, I don't know, how was that on the ground, guys? How did that feel?
I just from the weight of it, it's the greatest cyclocross racer ever in North America, and arguably, you know, in the list for the world, like, losing, and it's monumental. That being said, for whatever reason, I don't think it was a huge shock. The day of. What do you think, Zach?
No, I think, like, I mean, it was, I don't know. I, like, to me personally, it was like when she got passed on that run up, and, you know, at the beginning of the second lap, they kind of gapped her on that run up. It was like, oh, Katie Compton's dropping back. And I think there was this sense, and Clara even said it, she was like, we expected her to bridge, and when she didn't, it was just like, oh, I guess she's not going to come back.
Yeah.
I think everyone was engaged in the battle between Clara and Rebecca. I don't think there was, like,
Yeah.
You know, and to the credit of like Scott Herman, especially on the ground, I don't know how it was a live stream, but they were celebrating what Claire Hansinger accomplished. And I thought that was really cool. You know, because I think there's been past live streams or past coverage where you might obsess about, you know, what was happening to Compton. And I think it was really awesome that, you know, it was Claire's community. It was the Pacific Northwest. She had like all these fans there, but it was like celebrating what she accomplished and like a really great race, like between her and Becca.
Are you referring to Hartford and Jeremy Powers?
Yes. I am.
I'm just going to come out and say it.
Yeah, well,
one that came to mind.
So, like I said, I put on a race on Saturday and Sundays, but we actually Sunday finished up the race, like did a full social media block for like 2 hours after wrapping up, got home, like had to message a friend to send a link so we didn't have to like click on any sites so we could pull up the live stream and like was told where to go. And then we started with the women's race and me and my partner watching it. I mean, we were yelling at the screen. I mean, just like, it was so exciting to see that race play out. And it was, you know, I think they did a good job with the broadcast of like, in just how big of a moment that was. And man, I also want to note that it was sunny at the end and like the light came out and like you see these like amazing like photos like after the race, and it just like really helped tell that story. And I know that Clara said it wasn't a changing of the guard, it was a progression, but it did kind of feel like one of those moments. So I was super jealous that I wasn't there to watch it with you guys, or I don't know.
Yeah, well, I Clara, that I can see Clara saying that, but I can also see her underplaying kind of the weight of the moment. And for those of us who have followed this sport for a long time, I mean, it was huge. But it also, I think that part of it is that just the champion that Katie Compton is and the way that she handles herself and the perspective that she has, she kind of gave us permission to be happy for Clara. You know, I just think that that's kind of part of her greatness, is that she was like not taking any of the spotlight away from Clara's accomplishment, and was in defeat was more gracious than possibly she had been in all of the victories. So I kind of felt that was really cool as well, in that this was kind of an all around, just really feel good story. And it was the type of thing, unlike the men's race, where it was just an all out. The only thing people were talking about was how great the racing was during the women's race. And I really think you can't ask for anything better than that. And as far as how it played out, I think that it was something that if Katie Compton is on a good day, you know, and that's not an excuse, you know, she just wasn't, that, yeah, maybe she's still up there. But the course, the venue wasn't something that necessarily fit to her strength. I think there was some super technical sections, but the only barrier that you had to overcome with those sections was not crashing. And even though Katie was significantly faster on those sections than anybody else, they were way too short that it really didn't matter. You know, she could pick up a half second maybe going down there, but it wasn't going to make a difference as long as everyone else stayed on their bike.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, you know, we're there kind of like all week, and it's kind of interesting to kind of look at the course and how it played out. And I mean, to the credit of Rich McClung and Trombley is his last name. I totally forgot I'm blanking on his first name. David, maybe? Anyway, the course designers, they did a great job creating this like really well-balanced course, you know. You know, so I was kind of like, I was just musing on, you know, what skills did you need to have? And, you know, to me, it was running. I mean, the run-ups were just, they were steep. They were really, they put tow ropes for spectators to get up those run-ups. They were so steep. You had to be able to run. And the power game was really underrated, I think, in some ways. I mean, we saw some of the Masters racers where people were just like blitzing people on the power sections because it was these flat, just hammer, go really hard. It wasn't thick. I mean, I think Katie Compton would have benefited if it was thicker, but it did drain really well. They said it was going to drain really well, and it was like maybe like half an inch of like some kind of mud, and then it was just hard. I mean, yeah. It was...
And even the sections that were, you know, just completely saturated, it was just a puddle. It wasn't, right? Like the lower sections were still, you know, there was still carrying water, but it wasn't mud. It was just like running through. It was almost better because you're able to clean your tires off every time you went through the pits without having to actually change bikes. Because there was just a huge puddle with, like, as Zach said, you know, that only went down like an inch, and then you were on the ground.
Yeah, the pit puddle. I mean, we saw at Pan Am's when it was in Louisville that just absolute disaster near the pits. We've seen it at Jingle Cross. You know, it's just inevitable, and it was just, you know, here it was a puddle. It was like you could kind of pedal through it, and so I think that's one reason why Katie Compton last year at Louisville, even though it was not her best year, like Louisville was so thick. You know, that played to her strengths. And, you know, this year the run-ups were just like you had to be able to run really fast in a very steep, short bursts. And we saw that with Clara, that she had that skill. And so, yeah, so that was kind of like my takeaway was like you had to be able to run. You had to have good power game. And you just had to not crash on the descents. So, yeah, they could be decisive, but only if you screw up and you crash. But if you could just get to the bottom without falling off your bike, like, you were fine.
Yeah, and I think, you know, speaking of that, that was probably one of the decisive moments in that women's race where, you know, I just, you know, kudos to Farringer really coming at this race in a very aggressive manner. You know, we kind of talked about her this year and the way she's raced and sort of a change in the mental attitude. And it's very apparent. I mean, you know, it was apparent that no one was going to let Katie get an inch, especially in that first part of the course. Like, they were not letting her get a gap. And that first time that she passed Courtney McFadden on the downhill going like twice the speed, you're like, oh, this is Louisville all over again. But that didn't happen. You know, they chased her down. And yeah, you saw that one section in the run-up where Clara was just able to kind of ride it smoother and a little bit higher, opens a gap over Farringer, and, you know, the next downhill, Farringer bobbles, goes down, and, like, that's it. And then, you know, Clara has the gap, and she can hold it.
Yeah, and we said we were gonna like, brush over some of the other races to focus on the elites, but I think we saw that in a few of the other junior U23 races where someone was able to put pressure on and force other riders, you know, in these groups of two to make a mistake, you know, and that's really an underrated thing. You know, I think Clara knows that she can do that is by going and upping the pace, and then it puts, you know, in this case, Becca in the red, and she made that mistake, you know, that's like a vintage, like, good cyclocross move.
Yeah,
when you know that you're strong somewhere.
Yeah, and especially where it happened, and you're talking about these long run-ups, so Becca not wanting to lose any ground on the run-up probably was, you're right, in the red, you make that quick U-turn, and you look at it, Michael, of all of the, you know, UCI section-only sections or pro lines, the one where she ran into the fencing was probably the most innocuous of all of them. You know, it was just, just a miscalculation, just coming in there a little too hot. And that's what really cost her the race.
Well, and I wonder, you know, I guess also going back, it was not surprising. We were talking about in the green room of the podcast about some predictions that we made. And I think we said, you know, back in September, we were like, you know, Claire Hansinger is the favorite for U.S. Nationals. And I just kind of wonder how much she learned in that September, especially I just look at Rochester day two, Bill, you know, again, where she was just like, I'm going to drop everyone else in this field and chase down Magalie Rochette. And she was like, I can do this, you know, and I kind of wonder to doing that over the course of the season, winning races, to be with Becca and be like, hey, like, I can go really hard on this run up and it's going to put pressure on this other rider. And it, you know I can do this without blowing myself up. And so I just kind of wonder to what extent, you know, she was able to assert herself because of things that she's learned throughout the season. I would guess there's a good amount of that.
Well, she didn't, it seemed like she didn't really, you know, fall into the first lap and chill mentality that, or just race situation that she seems to for most of the year, where she's kind of working her way to the front by the end of the race. And she was kind of there at the beginning this race, which had to give her a little more energy to be able to control things from the front early. So I think that would be the one, you know, you talk about September and also with Rochester and that race, but I think that would be one significant change from how she was racing at that point to now, where she was a little more aggressive from the front end of the race.
Yeah, speaking of being aggressive, I thought it was cool to see Beth Ann Orton pretty much get the whole shot. You know, her teammate retiring after this race. And at first you're like, oh, is that Claire? No, that's Beth Ann Orton, like moving herself up from second or third row, like just right to the front. And I'm like, I think it's going to be a good race for Team S&M. You know, that was a cool thing.
Well, I think there was a lot of, I mean, throughout the week, we talked about, oh, this was a Grodio thing. On Grodio, we talked about like the home court advantage. I think there was a huge just, you know, Pacific Northwest home field advantage. I mean, Courtney McFadden raced out of her mind. You know, that was her home. It was a de facto home game for Claire Hansinger. You know, we just saw a bunch of other, you know, throughout the Masters races, Pacific Northwest riders kind of do really well. So it's just cool to see, you know, the crowds were great, especially at the descents. People were just going bonkers. And it seems like some of these local folks really fed off that. And it was cool to see.
Yeah, you could see on the live stream, you know, the crowds were big and they were running back and forth. And I was trying to think, I always remember being at Louisville and not thinking it was actually, you know, you had that one downhill Louisville that a lot of people were at, but like as a photographer, you could get around fairly easily. And I was like looking at those descents. And I'm like, how are they like, I don't know. It's like kind of too deep there. Like there's like, it's a little full. This is a cool vibe.
I think that this was a race that, and this is kind of what you want, look good on TV. I would, and this is not detracting from the event at all. I'd like to see what gate numbers for this race were compared to Louisville, because the sense that I got, and this is just unscientific, just kind of walking around and everything, was that there were more people at Louisville than there were here.
Interesting.
It was just that they were all concentrated in that one channel between the descent and the run up, and that's where everyone was, and then a smaller crowd on the second descent, and then nobody at the first run up because it was just too remote. Nobody back in the orchard, so it was really a concentrated area of crowd, which you want. I mean, it was kind of like the pit, you know. I mean, kind of a Zonhoven. Everybody was kind of in this one section, and it was an absolutely great vibe. But I to be perfectly honest, I think, and Zach and I kind of chatted about this earlier in the week. We were like, huh. Not as many people as have been in other cyclocross national championship weeks leading up to the main event on Sunday.
Yeah, I think, though, it lends itself. I mean, I don't think we're ever going to have Euro crowds where they're lining rando spots. But, you know, from a course design standpoint, we like to talk about that. I think it's brilliant. I mean, I think even going to like a local race, it's like if you can get people to concentrate and at least have good crowds in one or two spots, that just totally contributes to the vibe of the event. And it contributes to the vibe you come away as a spectator, because if you're in that pit, it was awesome.
Yeah,
it was so
for sure.
Cool. Like it was jumping. People were cheering. And so you're going to come away from that and be like, cyclocross is awesome. Like this was an awesome nationals. Your vibe are going to be good. And so, you know, I don't know if they intended it that way, but it worked out perfectly, right? Because, Michael, it was like you went to one descent, you had enough time, and there were people just massed at the crossing. It was bonkers how many people were at this course, these course crossings, and they went to the other descent, and then they walked back to the other descent. And it worked out really well, and I'm sure everyone that was there came away just feeling like they were at a really cool event. And, I mean,
I can tell you one. Story where that made me very happy is that a good friend of mine, Matt DeLorme, who's a photographer who I worked with for Trek in Europe for several years, lives in the Seattle area. I've never covered cyclocross, probably never been to a cyclocross race. And I was like, dude, you got to come out. And, you know, so if you looked at like Trek site, all the Katie Compton photos, those were his. So he showed up and took some photos, but he was like there and doing it. And, you know, this is a guy that covers downhill for World Cup races, covers cross country. He was like, this is amazing. This is the best. I love cyclocross. And he was just like sold. And I think it was exactly that environment. Like, he didn't want to leave that area. Like, he was just going from those sections where all the people were and just the vibe of it. And the music that like Hadala was playing there. I mean, it was just a really, really cool scene. And that's why I was like, again, that I wasn't being a detractor from the other thing, because you're right. If it was by design, it was genius. If it just sort of happened that way organically, also awesome. But that little section was just a huge party zone. And Zach, just thinking about it a little further, I have to think that it was by design, because that's where the beer garden was as well. So they kind of knew.
So the other beer garden was by the sand pit.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is typical, and it was sparsely attended, but that other beer garden didn't show up on the first day.
Right.
So I don't know if that was an audible that they called to create.
Interesting. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, maybe it was planned, but definitely the other beer garden was much bigger, and it was over by the sand pit, which kind of turned out to be a dud, because wet sand is usually pretty easy to ride through.
They spent a lot of time, I'm sure a lot of money, like trucking in all of this sand, and the sand pit was just like complete non-factor, especially since it was hard. I mean, don't get me wrong, there were, even at the elite level, there were still people who were three quarters of the way through and having to dismount, but it wasn't like fluffy, it wasn't dramatic, there were no roosters, there was no like struggle through it. You know, if you hit the right line, you were pretty much straight through it, and other than that, you were just kind of like dead ending into there and having to dismount and run. And it was sort of at that the end of the lap, like, that didn't really attract a lot of attention.
Yeah, well, and it's like part of that, I think, too, is because it was so easy, relatively speaking, for the elites to ride. It reminded me, I just remember in, I think it was 17 at Jingle Cross or 16 when it was wet, that sand pit at the bottom of the hit. But like, there was a year it was wet, and so everyone was riding through it like it was concrete.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that sand pit is nothing. Like, oh, blah, blah, blah. And then I remember pre-riding the course in 17, and it was fluffy, and I got like 8 feet into it and just like stopped. And I was like, oh. I thought this was supposed to be a lot easier. And so I think that's the thing, like the precipitation and the moisture just turned it into like, It neutralized it.
That was the year I think I was like spending running around with the gimbal a lot. And I remember running through the sand pit during one of the inspection times and just passing people, just like running through there and just like weaving my way through bikes as people were like riding, because it was so heavy at Jingle. And I was like, I'm just killing you all just running.
So that's it's like it's kind of interesting, right? Like, I felt like Louisville, I mean, I had heard from people, even if the crowds were bigger, they were like, oh, it just doesn't seem like it has the same energy. And so, you know, maybe if we're talking about American cyclocross and what we need to do, we need to think about with our course design, have it creating this situation where people come away with positive vibes. Because I mean, everyone you saw on social, everyone came away just stoked about this nationals. And so, you know, maybe we're never going to have like every inch of the course lined with spectators like in Belgium. But, you know, knowing that we can create this really positive vibe from our events by getting party zones, as my friend likes to call them, you know, I think that's a lesson to take away from this nationals.
I mean, speaking of like course design in the broadcast, I think what was interesting, and this is the media pit, is the drone, the live drone coverage. I mean, people were freaking out about that. There were some dead spots in the like the static cameras, and during some of the races, you miss some of the action. So it's like, once again, it's like finding that balance of like designing a good course, but like, can you get every angle covered? Because Bill, I mean, you're telling me that like in the junior race, like they missed the move with Andrew and you were able to catch it. So it's like the drone is cool, but like if I'm going to get the drone and I'm still going to get a blind spot like later on, like I don't know if it's worth it. I don't know. Like that was my one like critique. Like they had some good like content, like other packages, and they did the throw to Dave, and I was like, are you throwing to Dave because there's a blind spot in the coverage? Because I don't want to throw to him if the race is happening.
I will tell you this, is that is more, and one of the reasons that you see that this doesn't happen in Belgium is that the races are constructed to be made for TV. And speaking with the production team on this one, they had more cameras than any other nationals. So this same team has been covering Asheville was their first year, and they just came in there just completely green and with not enough equipment, and it's kind of been the same team ever since, and they've, you know, sort of built it up, and I think done just a wonderful job just making it better and better in every year. But this was a huge challenge, and I think they had 17 cameras out there and still dead spots.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's just, it's tough, you know, especially it was up in that orchard section. So they had one camera. And when we say camera, I mean, these are like the same cameras. Like these guys are covering, you know, NFL level games with these cameras, yeah, and then moving it's that same equipment. Like it's just insane the throw that these cameras have. So like the finish line camera was, what would you say, Zach? I mean, that had to be like almost close to a quarter mile.
Oh no, I was blown away because I was like, I popped in to the media pit there, and like they were zooming in on the front row, and I was like, that camera is literally a quarter mile away. This is insane.
Yeah, it was. I will say the problem with that I was kind of happy with my footage versus theirs is that they were losing focus on the guys crossing the finish line if you watch it. So,
oh
yeah, I mean that's such a small depth of field when you're at that in the lens.
Yeah. So they had two of those level cameras up top, and the drone was less effective up there because of the orchard. There was a lot more tree coverage, so it was tougher to sort of follow that. And that's where I think that they fell down. And then Zach and I were talking about this again, and it's all, I'm sure that I didn't talk to the director. I'm actually curious. I may go back and chat with him, but just where they put their static cameras, the ones that weren't manned at all, and just curious on what the decision making was there, because and I noticed it at Trek as well. It's like, I just think it's, if you're only capturing a half second of action with your camera, like they had the one at the top of the run up, you had a camera on the run up and then you would switch to this other camera when they got to the top of the run up. And I'm thinking like, that's kind of a wasted camera because you already know what's happening there. And then you're going to pick up with the next camera around the bend. And so it seems like that one could have been used elsewhere. So some of those camera positions, I just felt like maybe they could use them better. But then I'm also thinking, well, if they had pulled it back farther into the orchard, they'd already like laid down like 18,000 feet of cable. So you pull it even farther away, and I'm sure that was part of the thinking. Then you're adding even that much more cable, and it just seems kind of nuts.
Yeah, I guess I was talking to someone, I don't remember who, but they were saying that part of what sells them on like watching Cross, if there is a way to watch it, is having those close-ups and being able to see the riders and stuff, and I just want to see what's going on, and that's why I really liked
you were about complaining about it for that reason.
I really liked about your Pan Am's coverage that, you know, a drone is perfect. Like I know which color kits, you know, by lap two, I know which color kits. I want to see what's happening, and you know, the orchard was kind of an opportunity to do that, and you know, up top, like because it was really hard, it was so big. To me, it's like, let's get the most. I just want to see the race. And, you know, I mean, admittedly, so last year in Louisville, I just watched all the races from the media room to do my reporting, in part because I was so sick of the mud. But in part because I could see all the, you know, it was great. It was the bowl, like, it just worked really well with that venue. And here I tried watching the first race, and I'm like, I can see more of it by just being out on the grounds and, you know,
interesting.
For better or worse, I just watched all the races. And, you know, to his credit, Scott Herman was doing a great job filling in the blanks. If something happened up in the orchard, I was like, oh, there was a pass. Make note of this. And so, you know, he was doing, you know, because he's, you know, him and Julie are just so pro in terms of their announcing. But yeah, that was kind of interesting. Like, you could see most of the race being down in the lower part of that course.
Yeah, it also is something that, Michael, I think that, you know, you having just covered it for so long, I mean, in the same way doing video, that I think that what Zach was talking about with the Pan Am stuff is that we kind of know what you want to see as far as gaps and everything else, and you're like, okay, even if your instinct is like this is a better shot just to zoom in tight on people, if you do zoom in and then pull out to give people kind of the race situation, that's a better perspective. And I think that's something that, unless you have a camera crew, even though these guys are super pro and I'm sure they're in a union and do this every weekend at whatever professional sport they're at, they don't know cyclocross, you know? So it does, there are going to be those small little nits that, I mean, even just the people who are hardcore or need to, you know, at their job needs it to actually write an article are going to think that that's a short coming. And then, yeah, I mean, I think it just kind of is more of a credit to the people that follow it really closely, but not necessarily a knock on what those guys were doing.
Yeah, no. And also, like, I suppose I'm available for consulting on setting up TV cameras for cross races to the crew. You know, you guys are pros. I know you are. I laid some cable in the Superdome many times for a satellite truck. So
okay.
Hit me up. I think we should move on to the last sort of story point, yeah, the big storyline of this episode, and that's the crash or the case of
tape
the
gate?
Curious course tape.
Are we calling it tape gate?
I hate gate.
I shouldn't have even brought it up. We need something other than gate. Tape Gazi.
Tape gauge? Gauge gate? Tape Gazi. Oh my god.
Man, so where do we even start with this one? Well, Michael, you were on the stream. Like, could you tell what was going on from the live stream?
And if so, explain what we're talking about.
Explain what we're talking about. All right, so what is it? Second lap. Gage Hecht is off the front. Kerry Warner is closely chasing him. I don't know what. I think it's the one of the last
correct
downhills.
Yep, it was descents. The last one about just a few turns away from the finish.
So Gage is leading. I mean, he's sending it down the hill. It looks like it flattens out of a little bit of a road, and he like sort of bucks him into a nose wheelie, and he like careens off course through the tape. He saves it, stays upright, and you see the crowd like pull back. It's kind of dramatic on the live stream. And he sort of turns back into course and rides just like as you kind of would do. Like you're so used to like that tape breaking. He just like gets back on his bike and rides. And here comes Kerry Warner's behind him, and he gets taken out by the tape that has not broken. And I have ideas what happened there. And that, you know, at that point, it was Gage and Kerry kind of had a gap over Curtis and Steven. And Kerry crashes, Gage is gone, Steven and Curtis go past him, and Kerry's sort of like race for the win is over at that point.
And then how did Twitter respond?
Well, I mean, the first thing that I saw that was sort of a negative or questioning that situation was Rebecca Ferringer saying that was the moment he should have been DQ'd. And I hadn't even thought about that until she brought it up. And so you had plenty of people sort of who were agreeing. I think you had some people who weren't, but it sort of kind of boiled down to looking, trying to find a rule, I guess, in the USAC or the UCI rule book that if you exit the course, you have to enter at the same point, and something about impeding a rider. So people were trying to find actual, like, was there actual a reason to DQ him? But at this point, it seems so past the point, like, it's not enforceable, and it didn't seem like an enforceable thing anyway. I mean, I don't know. What was it like on the ground, guys?
On the ground, unless you were there, we had no idea.
Yeah.
Right, Zach? I mean,
I saw, so I was looking over, and yeah. I saw Gage get all caught up, and I was like, oh, shoot, something happened to him. Carrie must have passed him. So I could only kind of see Gage. And then I'm like, Gage comes out. And I'm like, what just happened? And, you know, I think Scott Herman was kind of describing what happened. But, yeah, we didn't know. We just know that he went down, that there was a crash.
Yeah, I knew. Yeah. But my explanation came again from one of these professional cameramen. Because the nice thing about those enormous cameras is that they're also monitors. So when they're not live for their camera, it shows they can watch the feed on their in their camera. So I was actually up in the orchard hanging out with my boy who was running one of the cameras back there waiting for them to come back. And he's like, oh, the leader just crashed. And I'm like, what? And he couldn't really explain it to me exactly, because he doesn't know cyclocross. Yeah. So it was kind of funny just trying to figure out from him what was going on. So we had no idea, really. But Zach, was there a rule infraction?
I think we determined that there wasn't. You know, I think there was some debate about, right, it come like the downhill mountain bike rule where you kind of have to leave enter the course where you leave. Because I looked at it, I must have watched this video like 15 times from different, you know, different perspectives. But he went out, he skipped an entire block of between two course tapes. So he skipped, I don't know, whatever we're going to call that, you know, 20 feet of course or whatever. If they were 10 feet apart before he came back in. But we determined, I think that's not the rule.
Yeah, there is no real specific cross rule that you have to go back to where you exited the course to re-enter the course. I think that's also in road. And then I think part of that is also you have to, A, it has to be intentional, and B, you have to gain an advantage from it, neither of which happened in that instance.
That's one thing, though, like, I mean, he kind of did gain an advantage because he was trailing course tape behind him that clotheslined Kerry Werner's front wheel.
I mean, yes, in the Mario Kart version of gaining advantage, sure. But just as in the sort of topographical and, shortcutting it, I don't think necessarily he did.
Okay. So one thing from a course design perspective that I was kind of curious about is what if they had decided to put hay bales at the bottom of that descent? It was a UCI-only descent. Would we be looking at a different national champion if there were hay bales there?
Or snow fencing.
Or snow fencing, because Gage would have crashed. He would have gone down, and maybe Kerry wouldn't, you know. Would Kerry have avoided him? So it was just kind of interesting to me, the decision to put course tape at a location where there's the potential for crashing, where we might see hay bales on a different course.
Yeah, or even like just metal barriers, since that was actually a part that was near the big team tent area that people could be crossing there. And, it, you know, every time there was a little road section or whatever else, there were metal barriers there. If those were metal barriers, then he's just kind of done for. But it really wasn't a spot in the course that you would expect somebody to come off like that. And one of the things, you know, what Zach was talking about earlier, that, you know, basically the game was to stay upright and you were fine. But what we saw time and time again from Sarah Sturm in the single speed race leading it to, I think, Michaela, I'm blanking on her last name, the Boulder Juniors, junior women racer who really just like scorpioned off that same section that Gage crashed on, but like to the middle, not to the edge of it. That there were like these like dirt gremlins that would come up and just kind of grab your wheel, and you never knew where they were or where they were going to come out of, and you think you'd ridden the perfect line, and all of a sudden you're just like down on the ground, and that's really what I think happened with Gage here. I mean, it was just one of these like fluke, you know, bad lines that, and then just the aftermath of it was just like, just like super unfortunate that he's dragging this course tape and basically, you know, clotheslining Carey behind him. You know, there's just,
yeah, I had to assume that Carey, you know, because I think who was saying, like, and maybe Zach, you were saying the groom, like, did Carey have a chance to go to the left of him, you know, and he went to the right, and you hear on the live stream and on Twitter, people are like, oh, Carey hit too much front brake. I'm like, yeah, right, like, Carey hit too much front brake. Like, he's a really skilled rider. I think, I'm guessing that he had to assume the tape was going to break, right? Yes. Like, Gage is coming back out in the course. Like, you see the tape break. You know that's going to happen. And he's thinking, okay, well, I'm going to stake my line, and it's going to break. Gage is going to break it, and I'll ride through. But unfortunately, no, it caught his front fork and pulled him down.
Yeah, I think the problem is, I'll bet you that's exactly right. But if you think about it, when you break tape, it's usually like what Gage was doing when it's like stuck on your, you know, on your saddle or something like that, and you're dragging it and then it snaps. I don't think you just like break straight through it normally.
I think he thought that Gage was going to break it, sure, beforehand, yeah, and then it would be down by the time he passed. That's sort of my, yeah, looking at it, but who knows?
What was going through my head is that it reminded me of one of the times that I got hit by a car in DC, and it was actually to a car and a van that had T-boned each other in the intersection and then were like sliding towards me, and the only decision I had to make was, do I want to run into the van, or do I want to run into the car? And I correctly chose car and then just like flew over the hood, because it's just like one of these things, like, what the hell do I do? Like, this whole thing is like closing in on me, and I mean Kerry Werner is arguably the best bike handler in the men's field, so if anybody's going to be able to kind of, you know, MacGyver his way out of there with his bike, it's going to be Kerry. So I don't know what he could have done to avoid that.
Well, and part of the problem too is, like, on a technical feature like that, usually there's a line that you ride, that you pick, and when you choose to deviate from that line, you crash. And so I'm sure, yeah, to your point, Michael, is he was probably like, my best bet is to hope this tape breaks, because, you know, by the time he kind of knew what was happening, it looked like he would have had to cut hard left, and chances of him going down are pretty,
yeah,
high at that point. But no, I was Zapruder-ing it to be like, all right, if Carey made a decision at this point, I was just like, you know, but like, you didn't know what was happening. It all happened so fast. And, you know, by the time Gage was coming back onto the course, like, decisions were made, like, you know, everything was cut. I felt gutted. I mean, you know, Carey had a great year. And frankly, like, in that race, he did what he needed to do. Gage got off to a very fast start, and Carey bridged, and he got, yep, up there with him in very quickly and impressive fashion. And, like, you know, Carey came in wanting to win that national championship, and he did everything right for two laps to win, to be in a position to win that race. And so I felt gutted, but at the same time, like, Gage was so apologetic. He apologized when I talked to him. He apologized on the live stream. You know, he was like, he felt horrible, and Carey handled it so professionally. Like, Carey was just like, it is what it is. It was a great race. I had a great time. Like, I was really impressed how both of those guys handled what happened.
Yeah, and yeah, I think that Carey also made a comment that that Gage was on a really good day, and he was working really hard to keep up with them. Like, that if he had asked him to come through, he may not have been able to. So I think, and that's the part that is disappointing for me, is that I think that Gage won that race fair and square. I think he was the strongest guy on the day. I would have loved for Carey to have given him a battle. I mean, I think that's what we all wanted to see, and it would have been an awesome race. But just a couple points that I think people have missed out on when they're screaming for Gage to be disqualified. Carey would not have won if that were the case. Curtis White would have won. And for that's the kind of the first point. And second, I just feel bad that this is like somehow tarnishing Gage's national championship that he absolutely earned and was the strongest guy out there. I mean, bar none. I mean, it's not like Curtis and Hyde were like tracking him down. You know, they didn't get impeded at all, and they couldn't catch him, even though he went off the course and was like caught up in tape for a little while. So you know, I just that's the part that kind of bums me out, that somehow this is this whole controversy that has been created is somehow taking away from Gage's accomplishment.
Well, so to back up a little bit, I mean, what Gage accomplished, it was a very interesting kind of game plan that he had. I went back and I did watch enough to see that it was that the first UCI only section, he had gotten to the bottom and he kind of, this is first lap, he bailed, he ran, Curtis tried to ride it, and Gage got a gap, and Gage just rolled with it. So I was just really impressed with, like, his confidence, and he must have been on a good day, because, I mean, he just laid down. He got an early gap and was like, y'all are going to have to chase me down. You know, what did you... I just thought it was really interesting and really awesome to see him be so assertive from early on, and it just totally did. It was like Stephen Hyde said, like, you either got on the boat or you missed the boat.
Yeah, I mean, Gage pretty much led that race from the run-up. He took the lead. I mean, Carey was the only one, as you mentioned, Bill, to bridge. Curtis and Hyde couldn't. Carey made the bridge, and at some point, Carey did pull through maybe the start finish, but yeah, Gage led that race the entire time. And to go back to what you're saying, like, if they had not crashed, like, what would have been the battle between Carey and Gage? And, you know, like, looking back at the women's race, like, yeah, there's technical sections, but also a lot of power sections. And I mean, I don't know. I think it's a pretty incredible. I wonder if it's going to be marred that bad. Like, I feel like, you know, what's interesting is the amount that Rebecca Ferringer, you know, Carey's teammate, has sort of been vocal about this whole incident on Twitter. And, you know, she's even very self-aware in the fact that she's like, look, like, I'm his teammate. Like, I can stand up for him and I can take some of the flack and I can sort of say maybe things that are a little bit outrageous. But I get the sense that, like, at the end of the day, like, we're all good. Like, everybody's good. And, like, I think we're going to remember that, like, Gage went hot from the gun and, like, stuck it, you know, and Stephen Hyde, Curtis White couldn't bring it back, you know?
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, and it wasn't for lack of effort. Curtis White. Well,
for sure.
When he finished, he had, like, that 1,000-yard stare of, like,
that was another, like, I don't even know. Place.
But, like, he buried himself. Yeah, like, sure. He had that look in his eyes, like, he had nothing left. And, like, I mean, he was just at the finish, just, like, staring off into, like, you know, the distance, just being like, I gave everything I had. Like they laid it all out there. And Gage was just that good.
Do you think he took any consolation in finally beating Logan Owen in a national championship race?
Well, my concern is, like, now he's got Gage to contend with. Yeah. Like, I mean, I want Curtis to win a cyclocross national championship. He's another guy. I feel for him. I mean, he's been so good, and just there's always someone at this point. He's only 24, so plenty of cyclocross left to go. But you know, you never know. You never know in sport, right? Like, what's going to happen in the next year. But yes, he did beat Logan Owen. So yes,
more more predestined. Curtis White finishing second, or Courtney McFadden finishing fourth.
Well, I mean, you can McFourth probably. More predestined.
It's kind of her spot.
And I know she wanted it. I mean, she was in third. Like, she had a gap for third too, so tough finish. But, you know, I mean, even she was like, I'm disappointed, but again, the vibe was just so great. And I think just everyone talked about the vibe. And I think, you know, Carey, I thought it was cool. He said, I wanted to give up, but everyone was cheering so much. I was like, I guess I got to try. You know, you guys motivated me to not throw in the towel and drop back to sixth or seventh, and to have, you know, to race against Lancey Pants and ultimately give Fort. So, I mean, I think that's really cool. Like, that, you know, that the crowd can kind of urge him on and kept him in the game. And, you know, he still fourth place is not a bad result. All right, so I mean, I brought it up like on social, like cross move or weak move, wide angle podiums for amateurs at nationals.
There was a debate on it. Was not set. There was a debate even up until they were the first day they were giving them out, and I think that the decision was made that these people are traveling from all over the place, paying the money to be there. If you are, you know, in an amateur race and in the top five, you know, why not give them the recognition, right or wrong? I think that was the rationalization for it. But the original, they were gonna hardline it originally and go three.
Well, because it was did it start in Hartford? Because I remember Molly Cameron dabbing when she finished fourth, I think, in Hartford. Was that the first year that they did it?
I feel like they've been doing it for a while.
I honestly can't remember.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember.
But what are your opinions? Is it cross move or weak move to do it?
I say cross move.
Yeah.
I think it's cool. Like, basically echoing what Bill said. I mean, like, especially for the amateur or the masters categories, you know, I probably wouldn't do a five podium in the non-championship race. You know, I wouldn't even do a podium, you know, like you'd lose cross points if you podium that race. But I think in the lead snow, keep it three. The UCI races, the UCI categories, keep it three. But I think it's cool. You know, somebody from, you know, who's got a day job and, you know, trains on the Zwift and, you know, gets fourth at Nats. Like, that's a thing you can tell your coworker the next week over the water cooler. Like, yeah, I'm fourth best in the nation. Like, I'm on the podium.
I just was always I am extremely selfish for these things. So when it came to organizing races, it's so much easier if you just go to three. But then we always go to five anyway, so.
Okay.
My local races, we do three, but I think at the national, like, at cross
seven,
nets.
Seven I draw the line at. Seven, oh, nine, man, 11.
Yeah. Yeah, you've never been to a Wars Wisconsin off-road race that does 10. It's just comical. The podium actually has five spots on it, and then they just kind of like keep fanning out.
Yeah, the Mid-Atlantic Super Series for mountain biking up in Pennsylvania, they will throw, it seems like, the whole field up there. It's pretty hilarious.
Well, so you guys agree. I said it. I think it's a cross move. I think it's really cool. Like, you go to Nats, like, finishing top five at Nats is a pretty big deal, especially in some of those big fields. And, you know, I'd be open to it. I know, like, some of the, you know, if you do a race, like, if it has 100 people and you're giving a podium to three people, I'm cool with, you know, maybe, like, for bigger fields, even at the amateur level, you know, making it five. I don't necessarily think you should do five if there's 12 people in the race, but I don't know. I was totally okay with it. It doesn't seem like it was that controversial, but there's some people that are like, why are there five spots on the podium?
Yeah. It's like, yeah. No, I'm fine with it. I'm fine with it.
Okay.
All right. Hour 15. Cool. Yeah, you know what I have to do?
Huh?
I have to start loading up the data fields for the algorithm for the final CX heat check of the year. I did the one for the broadcast, which was just American based, and there was a little bit of ruffled feathers from up north that they were not included in what they thought was the final heat check, but it's not. We're bringing it all together.
And apparently, and then they were still ruffled even after you said they were going to be included. They were still ruffled.
And it's going to be unnamed person. It is going to be something that I don't know how it's going to play out, but man, up to, I'm just thinking, like, the women at the top is going to be something, because wow. You know, you got people like Magalie Rochette, who still have had an awesome year, and then you have somebody like Clara Hansinger, who has dethroned, I'm sorry, the, what is it, has progressed.
Yeah, I mean, I was curious, like, you know, I'm sure I can see, actually, Bill, I can see behind you, you've got the vacuum tubes, you're starting to hook them up, but I had wondered, like, is the last heat check, is it just going to be the top 11 at U.S. Nats? But duh, no. you gotta include the North Americans.
Yeah, and the thing is, I apologize to everyone who competed at NBX and also at Resolution, that there just much like we just couldn't do the media pit, it also the heat check also kind of suffered from our tight travel schedule. So there are a lot of factors to be considered for this final one. And also I think that, you know, some of the criticism that the heat check has taken over the last couple of weeks, when the decks were kind of cleared of people who were load managing, that it no longer seemed like it was a cumulative a ranking system, that I think that when it all comes into this last week, it's kind of going back to more of a bird's eye view of what has happened over the season. I think that's how the algorithm sort of is going to be compiling a holistic view of the year to see what shakes out on top.
So is it going to be sort of be like with the NCAA selection committee? It'll be like more of a body of work, kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
So because there's different stuff that goes into it, they consider for that, like your last 10 races or games, so like how you're playing recently. Conference championships play into that, nationals, if you will. Also, you know, big wins, and big losses. And so, like, let's say if you won a World Cup earlier this year, and then you've been racing the Toy Cup, how is that going to factor into
even to the point of, you know, and then you mentioned Toy Cup. I think that's really a difficult part of it, because you laugh, but because you have, like, you look at somebody like Katie Compton, Katie Keough, once they re-entered North American racing, all of their European results kind of just follow with them. So even if maybe they didn't have the results they wanted at nationals, you know, you have to sort of look at that full body of work. But then on the other side of the coin, you look at somebody like Katarina Nash, who is out there winning races right now in C2 races like the Toy Cup, but never came back to the U.S. to race. So what do you do with her?
I feel like right now I can guess what the top three women will be. I'm just like writing it down. I think I have an idea of who it'll end up being. Yeah. But like the men's a more interesting case, because I think the case could be made that Gage was not dominant during the bulk of the season. Yes, he won Nats, and he delivered at the biggest race, and there's a lot of heft to that, you know. But you know, it was the Kerry and Kenny show for most of the season, Kenny and Curdy show. So that'll be interesting. I cannot predict what the algorithm is going to say on the men's side.
If you look at that head to head, Curtis wins, right? Because he is now 11-10 in head-to-head matchups.
Hmm.
But then, like, Gage won Elite Nats, so let's like,
right? No,
he,
no, I know.
Does
I,
he
I
go
know
to the
same,
top?
We,
like,
you know,
where's
we
there controversy?
We've been watching that kind of head-to-head between Curtis and Kenny all season long, and it kept going back to getting tied, and now Curtis actually pulled
it certainly
ahead.
Would have been cleaner if Pan Am's played out at nationals, right? Like,
so
that would have been cleaner.
That's where Tape Ghazi might really affect things.
Oh, okay. So then,
so what you're saying is Curtis White showed Gage a different. He's like in pre-ride. He's like, hey, Gage, check out this outside line.
Like, you can win. I just may have to make sure I get ahead of Kerry.
Yeah,
because of the heat.
And it feels
check.
Like less of a heat. If we're taking like a bigger view, it's like less of a heat check and more of like a simmer check.
Yeah, because I mean, that's kind of true as well. Ooh. And again, none of us know how this is going to really pan out. But if you think about it, if you want to go just straight on the pure definition of heat check, Cage wins hands down. I mean, you just described it, Zach, what you were talking about. I mean, he was off the front running that first section. That is the absolute NBA definition of a heat check.
Yeah. Well, and I will say, I would say that Ferringer heat checked with her big move when she went to the front in that first lap.
Like, yeah.
Ferringer definitely did a heat check to her credit in the elite women's race as well, I would
say. She brought it. She brought it.
You know, even though he didn't win, I would say that Magnus Sheffield is kind of the heat check king.
He is like a walking heat check, isn't he?
He's like
the shoulder check king.
He's like, boys, I will see you later. I'm going up the road. You can come if you want.
Well, but then it's like, but then, I mean, because of the way things play out, we have like, you know, Maddie Monroe just dominant in the junior women's race and Katie Klaus just dominant in two different races, both collegiate. I mean, collegiate varsity probably doesn't count, but like she was pretty dominant in winning her titles. And so the algorithm is going to be cranking, and I'm sure it's going to be doing a lot of, you know, the Monte Carlos that baby is doing are just going to be like endless to finally get at the final results.
Yeah.
Well, now I think that Anthony Clark's going to get in the 11th spot for his third place of single speed nets.
I mean, that 11th spot is typically the outlier. So who knows? Let's say, and I'm not saying it's going to happen because I have no idea. If Anthony Clark were to like squeeze in there in the 11th spot, will the heat check get more or less shit than Jeff Kabush being in that spot?
I have to say less shit.
Yeah, I think that would go. That would be.
I
okay.
think the people like yeah. Anthony Clark. You know, I put a poll up on my You're Right Instagram before asking if Anthony Clark would win single speed nats, and it was like a 90%. Yes vote on that one. So
wow.
Yeah.
I just have to say, like, I mean, I know we talked about like he's got family stuff or whatever, but I would say on the whole, like, Anthony Clark is such a positive for the cyclocross scene. Like, he was working the pits, he was congratulating people at the finish line, he was coming up to dudes and like, "Dick, man, that was awesome. You were so great. Like, that was so wonderful." I mean, like, he was just bringing so much energy like to that event, and not just in his race, you know, you saw it, people were cheering for him like crazy. But I think he's such a positive for American cyclocross. Like, his energy is just so
great. If you were
to
rank Anthony Clark versus your flight attendant, who was more positive?
Anthony Clark. So the story is, Michael, I was like getting off my flight. I was in the last row, and so I was the last person off, and I was like, "Hey, have a good one." She's like, "That's it." She's like, "Keep it posy." And I was like, "That is just a metaphor for this Nats, and I'm going to keep it positive." She was right. It was great advice. But no, Sick Watts was great. Like, just see, you know how Anthony talks. He was just like, "Yeah, man, that was great. You were great out there. That was killer. Yeah." It was awesome.
Perfect.
It's like everyone finishing. It was great.
Awesome. Well, I would say, I think for the most part, we did keep it positive. And Michael, we missed you out there.
I missed being out there.
Yeah. Even 8550 Dan showed up. Hi, Dan.
Dan had a great shot of the trees. So shout out to Dan. Finally delivered on a tree shot for me. I will be in Chicago, though. I, like I said, I had a moment of clarity. Not skipping Nats again.
All right.
All right. We'll see you there. Book
yeah,
it.
And
I'll
Zach, we're going to race.
Yeah. I think we determined you're an age up, so we're going to race against each other 2 years from now. But we'll both be in Chicago racing our bikes, so book it.
Awesome. Until then.
All right, cool.
No, we'll probably see each other before then. But
yeah, we got to keep the do we take a Euro turn now for the media pit? I guess we've got to go
full
on Euro.
I think we have to.
Michael, this is your time, baby.
Oh, yeah.
Time to shine.
Talking about dogs and streaks.
Can we put the streak on hold till next week? We'll talk streak next week.
Yeah.
The other streak.
Yeah. Perfect. The streak of one win. The one win streak. All right, Michael, any final words, places to go, things to do, tips, hot tips, book reviews? What do you want the people to know?
I gave all my hot tips and book reviews at the beginning of this podcast. So just find me on Instagram at YeahYouRide and find me on Twitter at LandSoftly.
All right. And Zach, where can people find out the latest on gravel news?
Well, funny you mention that. I believe we do have an episode of Grodio coming up soon. We're going to be doing the Grodies.
Yes.
We're going to be handing out some awards for 2019. Bill is going to sing the theme song for the Grodies.
the age honored tradition of singing the Grodio Grodies theme song. Yes.
Yes. But yeah, CXMagazine.com. It's a website. Oddly enough, it's called Cyclocross Magazine. We're still covering Cyclocross. We still got a couple months to go. And I myself am on Twitter at The Shoe Star.
Awesome.
And so, yeah.
You can find me at CX Airs on most social media. Also, go to YouTube and look up the CX Airs channel. And that's where I do most of my work other than podcasting these days. So go follow it there. All right, guys. It's been awesome. We'll see you soon.
Sounds good.
Good night.